Hey guys, I'm Katie.
And I'm Rebecca.
And this is Chills,
Thrills,
and Kills.
Yeah, so welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
All right, so we started our part one of a series last week. And so we started the case of the pizza bomber. And I've listened to a few episodes that do a couple multi-parters, and they don't really do a summary. And that doesn't work for someone like me who just has no memory of anything ever. So I'm going to do a quick little summary for you guys.
Yay! Okay, so can I ask you a question before you start your summary?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the guy's name, was it Brian Wells?
Yes.
Okay, so fun, quick, very quick story. One of my good friends that we shouted out in the first episode, Louisa, sent me a video clip of her telling her boyfriend about the story, and he goes, I got a shout out too, because his name is Brian Wells. So I just wanted to say hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. Yeah, you got your own special shout out, but hopefully you didn't get blown up.
No.
Okay, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my little summary. On August 23rd, 2003, pizza delivery man Brian Wells was possibly abducted from his work, then strapped to a bomb, and forced to rob a bank. After being apprehended by police, 30 minutes later on live television, the bomb detonated, killing Brian Wells before he could even reach step two of the wild scavenger hunt he was being sent on. Yeah. Now, a dirty blue van had been seen by investigators at the scene of scavenger hunt site number two, and then this blue van was never really mentioned again until much, much, much later. I have not yet covered that part. A co-worker of Wells, Robert Panetti, died just a few short days later of an apparent overdose, just one day before he could be interviewed by the police. Whether or not this was foul play, nobody ever really ruled on. On September 20th, a seemingly unrelated phone call was made to the state police. A man named Bill Rothstein reported a seemingly unrelated crime. There was a body in his chest freezer.
Ew.
Yeah, fun fact that I didn't mention in the other one, it was so frozen solid that the coroner said that it took them 4 days for it to fully thaw out.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty bad. So this body belonged to James or Jim Roden. Roden was the current boyfriend of Marjorie Deal Armstrong, who happened to be Bill Rothstein's ex-girlfriend. So, just a little weird. Rothstein admitted to helping Armstrong hide the body, but said he couldn't go through with destroying it, which is why he turned her in. Armstrong, who had once killed another boyfriend in 1984, eventually admitted to killing Roden and was sentenced to a mental institution. While investigators searched the property of Rothstein, they found what he had said was a suicide note, and, not at all suspiciously, bullet point number one was, this has nothing to do with the Wells case. Now, while that seems extremely suspicious to us, when asked why that was on his suicide note, he said, oh, I just didn't want to waste you guys' time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two investigators. And I guess they bought it, because up until the day that he died, which was before this was solved, they had cleared him as a suspect.
Not suspicious at all.
Yep, not even a little bit. He was a great guy. When we last left off, Trey Borzieri, I'm probably saying that wrong again, whatever, who is the producer of Evil Genius, the Netflix series on this case, had written to Marjorie Deal Armstrong in hopes she would give him information. And this is where we begin today.
Okay.
Yes. So, to Trey's surprise, Marjorie actually responded, stating that she had plenty of secrets in regards to the Wells case, and would share them in exchange for legal or cash assistance.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of sounds like there are local singles in your area, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
he did, in fact, help secure this legal assistance for her, and they began to correspond with one another. Now, I think it's important here to tell you a little bit about Marjorie, because I very briefly mentioned a couple of things in the first episode, but I didn't go too in-depth.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, she was extremely smart, but wasn't very well-liked. She wasn't popular or anything like that. She actually didn't have many friends until, I guess, she got some really fancy dollhouse that people wanted to play with.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess that was the PlayStation or Xbox of the day.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up, she didn't have a lot of friends, and throughout her life she had been diagnosed with several conditions and personality disorders. The most recent three were bipolar disorder, mania, and pressured speech.
Okay.
Now, I had no idea what the fuck pressured speech was, so I looked it up.
Mm-hmm.
It's most commonly a symptom of bipolar disorder and is described as an extreme need to share your every thought, idea, or feeling.
Oh, God.
Yeah, this is often a sign of a manic episode. Now, I've said this before, Katie said this before, we will say it many, many times again and again and again. You can have all of these disorders and not be a murderer. You can be a completely functioning, great member of society. Marjorie just was not one of those people.
Yeah, so mental illness is not an excuse.
It's not an excuse, and it's not an indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one psychiatrist actually believed that she wasn't really mentally ill. She just suffered from narcissism and a severe personality disorder.
Oh, that sounds more like it.
Yeah. Having several of my own narcissists in my life, I would have to agree with that one. When you look at Marjorie's past, you might be inclined to agree with this assertion. My uneducated self definitely does. Most of her relationships with men have appeared to be chaotic and extremely short-lived. She even said herself to some of these psychiatrists that one of her biggest regrets is that she felt she was unable to form long-lasting, meaningful relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
She was unable to hold a job and struggled with daily life. She let herself go and her home. I think, did I mention to you what was found in her home last time?
I don't remember.
All right, so they found, like, hundreds of pounds of rotting cheese in her home.
Oh my God.
And butter.
Why?
Because she was a hoarder. And that was just one of the things she hoarded, I guess.
Oh my God, okay.
Yeah, so that was a thing. When she was arrested for James Roden, the arresting officer actually recalled that she smelled as though she hadn't showered in a week. And this poor guy had to be in a car with her for, like, several minutes, taking her to the police station.
Gross.
Yeah. She had also had at least 5 other men in her life die prematurely.
Of course she did.
Yeah, so one was her late husband, Richard Armstrong, who supposedly fallen and hit his head on their coffee table.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Fun fact, she'd actually asked the hospital for a piece of his leg bone.
What?
Mm-hmm. And this was in case she could clone him in the future.
Ew.
Why the leg bone?
What are you gonna do with it until then?
Wear it as a necklace.
Oh my God, okay.
I don't know if that's actually what she was gonna do with it. It just sounded like a fun thing to say.
Use it as a staff. I don't know.
I mean, depending on how big that piece of his leg bone was. I was imagining, like, just a little shard.
See, I'm thinking she wants the full-on femur.
I mean, go big or go home, I guess.
Yeah.
So that was just a little bit of insight into Marjorie herself. In the only recorded interview she did with Trey, and when I say only recorded, it's the only full-on, like, professional interview that was recorded. He actually recorded all of his phone calls with her without her knowledge.
Which is perfectly legal in some states.
In some states. I don't know about in Pennsylvania, but...
All right.
Yeah, not my problem. In the only recorded interview she did with him, Armstrong actually confessed to him that she'd killed Roden, which at this point isn't very newsworthy, but she did change her story. So at one point she said it was because they were arguing about another woman. This time she says it was self-defense. There's actually another time where she told investigators it was because he was talking about the Wells case and she needed to shut him up, which is interesting because she claims to this day she's being framed.
Sure she does.
Yeah, so who knows? So this time it's self-defense again. She stated she didn't get any money out of it and she didn't want to kill him. She loved him and he loved her and he was so kind to her.
Likely story, but okay.
Yep. She then also felt the need to mention that it had nothing to do with the Wells case.
Which she's completely uninvolved with, right?
Mm-hmm. It's funny, though, how the words, "this has nothing to do with the Wells case," keeps being thrown around.
Okay, this has to be the name of this episode.
Nothing to do with the Wells case?
Yep.
Yes. Good job, Katie. We're doing that. She also told Trey that she knew nothing else of importance.
Okay.
It's weird that she said that, though, considering it's at this point that Armstrong actually wrote a "to whom it may concern" letter to the police.
Aww.
And can I just say, "to whom it may concern" just makes me think of my mom writing me letters to get me out of PE. Just, that's such a get out of school free card. So she sent them this letter in hopes that they would move her closer to her hometown. Keep in mind, you know, she knew people in her hometown, and then her money was there, and her attorney was a lot closer to there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Her bargaining chip was information about a cold case unrelated to the heist involving a man named Kenneth E. Barnes. The only information she gave, however, was an unsubstantiated rumor. Yeah, so not very helpful to you. They had actually been in the process of trying to get her moved, though, and then they were like, "this isn't helpful." She also utilized this time to bring up the pizza bomber, stating she knew that Bill Rothstein was involved, and that there was another person involved with him.
Okay.
A police investigator by the name of David Gluth turned that information over to the FBI, at which point he was asked to join in their investigation.
Okay.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen often, does it?
It really, from what I've seen so far, just being a true crime glutton, not really. There's usually lots of points of contention between the two departments, and it's usually very much, "no, this is my case, fuck off."
Mm-hmm.
But David Gluth and his, insight. So David's insight into this and deciding, "no, this is important, it shouldn't be shrugged off, this needs to be turned in," would actually eventually lead to Marjorie's own downfall, so she's an idiot.
Which, I kind of thought before that, but okay.
I mean, yeah, but it gets better. So now that she'd involved herself with the Wells case, he actually offered up the storage unit that the police department had kept with her belongings in it.
Oh, shit.
Yep. In the storage unit, which, again, Marjorie Armstrong is a hoarder.
Oh, God. Ew.
So there's a lot of fucking stuff in this storage unit. One of those items that were in the storage unit was an angry letter that Marjorie had written to a bank.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, the manager of this bank had allowed her father to empty out a safe deposit box that contained what she felt belonged to her.
Oh, God.
This bank was a PNC bank.
Of course it was.
Of course. The same bank that was robbed in the heist. Mm-hmm. Yep. Throughout the investigation, Marjorie continued to give investigators shallow answers. No new information surfaced until she spoke with Trey. She told Trey a story about a blue van at Rothstein's house that he'd had towed away. He'd only towed it back to his home when he'd been cleared as a suspect by the FBI.
What a coincidence.
Real strange. Upon hearing about the blue van, Trey realized that the same blue van had been in front of Bill's house the one time he'd gone to try and interview him. Now, Bill Rothstein had obviously denied this interview because I'm no longer a suspect. Why the fuck am I going to keep talking?
Right. Mm-hmm. Smart.
Yeah. Smart. Rule number one, shut your fucking mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Trey passed this information on to the FBI, who'd almost completely forgotten about the big fucking blue van. But had been spotted by police investigator Lamont King at the second scavenger hunt site. How do you forget about a vehicle of interest?
Yeah, that's kind of vital information.
Well, at this point, they decide, okay, we obviously missed some things, so we need to go back to square one and re-examine everything.
That's probably smart.
Yeah. Should have done it a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
As they're reviewing footage from Rothstein's home, you remember that fun little clip I played where he's walking them through and very coldly explaining which stairs had blood on them that he replaced?
Mm-hmm.
They noticed a diagram that had been drawn out. To Jason Wick, the FBI agent, he thought that one of the arrows looked suspiciously familiar, but he couldn't really place it, so he continued going through everything else, and then determined, oh, shit. These arrows look a lot like the ones we found on the homemade motherfucking bomb.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. So they then go back and look at the 9-page ransom, no, not ransom, the 9-page instruction note. The note had originally been typed, then on separate pieces of paper, they traced over the typed letter to avoid their handwriting being detected. Right? Why didn't you just give them the printed fucking letter, but...
Thinking too much about how they could get caught.
I guess just don't send them a floppy disk.
Yeah.
So special. Their handwriting was not detected. However, there were indentations on the note in the writer's own handwriting. So, like, they'd placed a piece of paper over this note and were writing on something else.
Wow.
And it pressed through to that note. Mm-hmm. They hadn't noticed this before.
How?
Mm-hmm. Who knows? At some point, they decide to show this to Bill's best friend, who then confirmed that it, without a doubt, was Bill's handwriting.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so all of the pieces are starting to come together just a little bit.
But how, what kind of a first, what kind of a best friend? Mm-mm.
What do you mean?
I don't think I would have told on my best friend.
Even though your best friend's already dead?
Yeah. Why, I mean, no. No, I don't think I would have told on them.
I don't know. If I watched somebody get blown up on live television, and you were of the mindset, no, my friend's a great guy, and then all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, my friend did this, I don't...
Okay, well, maybe if I knew about it beforehand, like, I was included in all of that, I don't... blowing somebody up is a bit far, I guess.
Yeah, like, if it was, oh, they robbed a bank. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. Built a bomb and strapped it to some guy's neck. Yeah, that, I'd turn you in. I'm not that good a friend, I guess.
Okay.
But I'm glad I've befriended you, Katie, and now I know I can get away with literal murder.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
In the summer of 2005, 2 years after the bomb went off, TV shows went to Erie to try and dig up some information. They were actually successful in finding new clues that the FBI and the police department were unable to.
Well, would you look at that?
I mean, I guess that's not that uncommon, though, because how many people are caught because of, like, 48 hours or, what the fuck's the, America's Most Wanted? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
A man named Professor Sedgwick, which just makes me think of Harry Potter for some reason.
It does.
So a man named Professor Sedgwick had been near the bank robbery site and saw a gold car driving on the berm of the freeway, going the wrong way.
What? Okay.
Yeah, my understanding is the berm of the freeway is that, like, side section that you're not supposed to drive on, and you're supposed to use to, like, pull over in the event, like, of a flat tire or something.
Like a shoulder? Kinda,
yeah. That's, okay. At least that's my understanding of it. I didn't Google it because I guess I'm lazy, but... so the two drivers had made eye contact with one another, and he, upon seeing her image, recognized her as Marjorie Deal Armstrong. Mm-hmm. He'd reported this back during the initial investigation, but was never interviewed.
Of course he wasn't.
Of course. When this information was brought to Marjorie, she stated, oh yeah, I'd been there. But she didn't know where she'd been going.
What?
Yeah, and it had nothing to do with the case.
Wow.
Yeah, you'd think you'd remember driving the wrong way on the freeway, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Another clue that surfaced came from Michael Thomas Vogt, a UPS driver. So, one night, him and his son were watching America's Most Wanted, and they recognized Marjorie. His son basically looked at him and was like, Dad, you need to call and tell the people the information that you have. Mm-hmm. So, Michael had observed both Bill and Marjorie at the payphone at the Shell station where the pizza delivery phone call had been made. Once again, she said she'd been there, but for a different reason.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, is kind of a smart tactic, because if you say you haven't been there, but then they have proof or witnesses saying that you have, it's a lot easier to convince them, yeah, I was there, but this is what I was doing, than it is to say, no, they're wrong. So, I mean, it is an interesting and kind of smart tactic, but she couldn't come up with another reason for any of these things or tell anybody where she was going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when her lawyer attempted to question her, she went on a rant about how she'd been in the top of her class and had 5 college degrees.
5?
Yeah. The look of I'm fucking done on his face, though, was so priceless.
I bet it was.
Like, every time he had to ask her a question, she'd go off on these bizarre tangents and he'd just be so over it. So glad I decided I did not want to become a lawyer, Jesus. The FBI at this point began interviewing fellow inmates. One woman, Kelly Michaela, had actually been keeping notes on Marjorie and her various statements. She had turned these notes over to the police and repeatedly asked them to turn them over to the FBI. They never were. And were instead put in a file labeled snitch letters.
What? Okay.
I guess the Pennsylvania State Police Department was of the mindset snitches get stitches or something, but...
Mm-hmm.
They put them in a box and left them there.
Okay.
These notes, however, showed that Marjorie had stated Bill built the bomb. It also stated that a man named Floyd Stockton, who had been Bill's roommate, was definitely involved.
Well.
She had also told Kelly that the heist was linked to the frozen body case.
Okay.
She'd also told Kelly that the heist was linked to the frozen body case. She had also specifically said, "It's not like we didn't measure Wells' neck for the collar."
What? Okay.
Uh-huh. So two women had actually heard this statement, so it wasn't just Kelly.
Okay.
After reading through these notes, the FBI requested an interview with Floyd Stockton, who, conveniently, was in prison at the time, serving time on charge of a rape against a disabled teenager.
What?
There was apparently a lot of trash in Erie, Pennsylvania at this time.
Yeah, I would say that's an accurate statement.
No offense if he lived in Erie, Pennsylvania at this time, but the specific people involved in this case, there's no way to say they weren't all garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Except for maybe Brian Wells. Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Continuing onward. On July 19th and 20th, 2005, Jerry Clark, the FBI agent, and Jason Wick, the ATF agent, were able to interview Stockton. During this interview, he exhibited behavior consistent with someone who had a lot of information but refused to give it up. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah. Like everyone else who's been interviewed, all of his answers were shallow.
Mm-hmm.
He did, however, say that both Rothstein and Armstrong were involved in both the bank robbery and the bomb plot because they needed money.
Okay. So these people just literally go with the first idea that pops in their head.
It seems that way, yeah.
Okay.
The first idea is always the best idea. Isn't that what you were told?
No, but okay.
Weird. Gluth eventually interviewed Kenneth Barnes, otherwise known as Cocaine Ken.
That's great.
The same one from the To Whom It May Concern letter, thinking that Ken had information. Gluth reported back to the FBI, insisting they look further into him. So, Ken and Marjorie had been fishing buddies, and he also had a mutual friend with Wells. This mutual friend was sex worker Jessica Hoopsick. So, here's where it gets... It's all been weird. Why am I saying here's where it gets weird? Mm-hmm. So, here's where these guys get weird, specifically. Wells would drive Hoopsick over to Barnes's home, where Wells would buy cocaine from Barnes, then give the drugs to Hoopsick in exchange for sexual favors.
Okay.
Yeah, Jessica, Hoopsick, swore she knew nothing about the heist and refused to answer any further questions.
Of course she did. I mean, I don't know that I would want to be associated with any of that.
Me neither. During a second interview, Barnes admitted that Marjorie had solicited him to do the bank robbery and kill her father. Her motive behind this was that her father was giving away her inheritance to his neighbors.
This just gets, I don't know, more interesting as you go, I guess.
It's really interesting and it's really convoluted. Trey actually went and spoke with her father to ask him what he thought of all of this. And the weirdest part is that Marjorie wasn't even in his will at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He had long since removed her after all of her crime sprees, and he'd said that everything they'd ever given her She neglected, obviously, hoarding and ruins a house real fast.
Mm-hmm.
So why she'd hire somebody to kill her father? So when asked why a bank robbery, Barnes had said that the bank robbery would provide Marjorie with the money to pay Barnes to kill her father. This information actually matched up with Barnes's prior interview in 2003 when he had stated that she wanted to hire him as a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
Not super sure why nothing came of the initial interview, but alright.
Yeah, great police work, though.
Mm-hmm. When questioned about it, Marjorie responded, "I've killed two boyfriends. Why would I hire someone else to do it?"
Oh, cocky. Okay.
But I mean, also fair point a little bit.
Okay.
I don't know. The way she said it, though, it sounded very unhinged. And if that was your way of convincing people that you're innocent, maybe not the best way to go about it.
Probably not.
Yeah, let me explain to you why I'm innocent while also telling you about killing two other guys.
Yeah, so just trust me on this.
Yeah, just trust me on this one. Like, the other ones, absolutely, I did it. But, like, this one, guys, I'm innocent, I swear.
All right.
Yeah, once he began opening his mouth, Ken Barnes became Marjorie's newest obsession.
Oh my goodness.
Now, not only was Rothstein the mastermind, but Barnes was as well, right alongside him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When asked to prove that Marjorie Armstrong didn't rob the bank, she would simply say, "I don't need to rob a bank. I'm rich."
Okay.
The statement wasn't entirely wrong. She was pretty wealthy from various lawsuits and money she'd received from her parents. However, it was revealed to Trey, the producer, that in 2003, she and Ken Barnes had fought about money that she owed him. She refused to pay him, and Barnes decided, "All right, well, if that bitch doesn't want to pay up, I'll just have my friends rob her."
Oh, okay.
They took over $100,000 from her, and no one was ever arrested for it.
Well, of course not. She probably wants to stay as far away from the police as possible.
I mean, maybe. Realizing that investigators were quickly unraveling the whole story, Barnes agreed to testify against Marjorie in exchange for a plea deal. So, on December 9th, 2005, Ken Barnes confessed to knowing the entire scheme and admitted to being in on the heist.
Okay.
He said that he, Armstrong, Stockton, and Wells himself were all in on the heist, and had had a pre-heist meeting on August 27th, the day before, to solidify their plans.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Barnes stated that his role in the heist was that he would be the lookout. Now, Barnes and Marjorie both met at the kidnap site, so the remote TV transmission tower. Mm-hmm. Brian then delivered the pizzas and was standing there waiting to be paid. Because apparently, while Brian was quote-unquote involved in this, he didn't know the day it was set to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Stockton then, I've only mentioned him a couple of times, so Stockton, Bill's roommate, then brought out the bomb and came up behind Brian, who was unaware that a real bomb would be used.
That's a pretty important detail, but okay.
Pretty important. Brian tried to run at this point, but Barnes apparently grabbed and punched him in the face, at which point Stockton put the bomb on him, and Armstrong put the "guest" t-shirt on him over the bomb.
Okay, the one that he wrote on with a Sharpie.
The one that Marjorie Armstrong, yes, she wrote on it with a Sharpie. She then concocted the story of the black men, telling him that if he was to be caught, he needed to say a group of black men had kidnapped and attacked him and then forced him to rob this bank.
Okay.
During the heist, Armstrong and Stockton were allegedly across the street watching through binoculars, which, while it seems extremely stupid, would make sense based off of their demands in the note, like the police setting off flares for compliance and whatnot. fucking wild. When the police were on their way, Barnes and Armstrong left to meet up with Bill and switch the vehicles. It was at this point that Marjorie was seen going the wrong way on the freeway. And it's believed that she was going back to the final stop of the scavenger hunt. Barnes swore that the entire time they had been planning the heist, the bomb, was supposed to have been fake. That's what had been agreed upon. And no one but Marjorie and Bill had known about the change in plans until the day things went horribly wrong.
This is making me nervous.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that I buy, but that's what we're going with thus far. In February of 2006, Marjorie is told of Barnes's claims, to which she states that he lied. She hadn't been with him, and Rothstein framed her. Now, they of course brought that back to Barnes, to which he said, nah, that bitch was there, and she was the mastermind.
Yeah,
So in March, on the 21st, and on the 5th of May, 2006, the FBI executed a search warrant on Barnes's home. They were searching for anything that could tie him to the crime directly, specifically any bomb-making components. Fun times for these officers. He was also a hoarder.
Oh my god. Ew. What are the odds?
Right? Three hoarders, one case.
Oof.
Wow. During the search, they found several magazines about how to build explosive devices.
Wow.
So I guess they found what they were looking for. Moral of the story, you guys, if you're gonna commit a fucking crime, don't be a hoarder and hang on to the evidence. That'll put you away. All I'm saying. On May 10th, 2006, so 5 days after that the final search of Barnes's home, Armstrong was taken for a ride by agents Wick and Clark, accompanied by her personal lawyer. They were trying to straighten out her story and determine where exactly she'd been on the 27th and 28th of August 2003. During the ride-along, they spoke of details of the case. And this part just amuses me. Marjorie mentioned during this ride-along that Bill Rothstein had requested 2 kitchen timers from her before saying, "That's it, we're done. I put my head in the lion's mouth. And I'm done."
Okay.
She wouldn't say anything else, but one piece of information that had not yet been released to the public was that the bomb had been built using 2 Sunbeam kitchen timers. Yep. While Marjorie becoming tight-lipped was frustrating for the FBI agents, they weren't too terribly concerned about it. Both Ken Barnes and Marjorie Deal Armstrong were so busy trying to point authorities in the other's direction that, you know, it was really backfiring on them both. And of course, neither of them knew what the other had said or hadn't. So the more they tried to remove fault from themselves, the more information these dummies unwittingly gave away.
Yeah, I see that.
March 27th, 2007, Floyd Stockton confessed to his role in the heist and agreed to testify against Armstrong in exchange for immunity. So the guy who actually strapped the live bomb to this dude's neck got immunity, but...
Okay. I would say I don't know. Especially since he knew it was a live bomb, he should be directly charged with his death, but okay.
Well, we'll get more into charges on his death in part three.
Okay.
So, Stockton stated that he may have helped make some pieces for the collar, but the pieces that he made didn't work properly and wouldn't function as needed. So he very obviously knew they were trying to make this a fully functioning bomb.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Bill Rothstein took over the creation of the device. Stockton said he'd been ordered by Rothstein to place the collar on Wells and that he did it out of fear for his own life.
Sure he did.
Mm-hmm. Upon leaving the clearing where this device had been strapped to Wells, Stockton said that he thought he would be shot in the back as he walked away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. Honestly, you fucking should have been, but...
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. In July of 2007, a federal grand jury who had been on the case for close to 2 years indicted both Barnes and Armstrong on the felonies of armed bank robbery, conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery, and using a destructive device in a crime of violence. Both Wells and Rothstein were named as unindicted co-conspirators.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to call it here because we're almost at an hour. But next week, we'll go into a little more depth on the possible involvement of Brett and Wells, how he came to be involved, if he was, the various theories on who was really the mastermind, and why, and the many unanswered questions left behind in this case, because there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is that. We are going to take a quick break, and then Katie is going to tell us a scary story.
Woo!
Yay!
Hey, Rebecca, guess what?
What?
I got my Heathen Hippo candle in the mail today.
Really? So did I.
Yeah, so I got the fireside scent, and it is literally my favorite thing in the world right now.
I got my white tea and fig scent, and same.
Yeah, they're amazing. Not to mention, our cute little logo looks so good on the front of this candle.
I 100% agree, and I don't know. I want to send one to everyone.
Same. They're super affordable. They're natural because they're made out of soy.
And because they're made out of soy and they're natural, they burn evenly, there's no lingering smoky smell, and they even use my favorite wood wicks.
Yeah, so that nice little crackle, oh my goodness.
Especially with fireside, I imagine that would be so nice.
Yeah, it's literally like I'm sitting next to a campfire in my cramped little studio. It's perfect.
I love it. So, guys, if you want one, there are 9 fragrances, 5 customizable font options, or you can get some of their really fun standard label options. They have some Joe Exotic ones that are calling my name. So, if you want to buy some of these adorable, affordable candles, go to Heathen Hippo on Etsy.
And you can use our little code, CTKPOD, and save 10%.
Yeah, so literally not seeing any reason you shouldn't do that.
So, head on over right now. Like, right now.
Right now, do it.
Hey there, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Noelle, and we are the hosts of the Quite Unusual Podcast.
A podcast about all things spooky, paranormal, strange, and unusual.
Are you a fan of all things macabre?
Do you love learning about unsolved mysteries?
Are you crazy for cryptids?
Then we think you might like the Quite Unusual Podcast.
On Quite Unusual, we talk about all the terrors and trepidations in the known world and beyond.
From the world's most nefarious cults to serial killers.
Hollow Earth theory to paranormal activities.
Local ghost stories to UFO phenomena.
Government conspiracies and, of course, unexplained events.
Nothing is off limits, but everything is quite unusual.
So sit back and get weird with us.
Find us on social media at Quite Unusual Pod, and you can email us at quiteunusualpod@gmail.com.
You can listen to us for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
And as always, remember to celebrate the strange.
And keep it unusual.
Bye.
Okay, back from the break.
Such a fun break. I went and got a guava juice mimosa.
Yum.
I know, it's pretty delicious.
I'm just drinking peach-flavored water.
I mean, that's probably healthier, so good for you.
Yeah, whatever. All right.
I'll send some through the computer for you right now. Hit download, did you get it?
No, and I have no space, so... Oh, well.
That's unfortunate, I'm sorry.
Okay, so... I'm just going to jump right into my story.
Great. I can't wait to hear what it is.
Okay. So first, I'm going to cite my sources. I used allthat'sinteresting.com, roadtrippers.com, travelchannel.com, wikipedia.com, and I also watched YouTube videos on the Travel Channel's channel.
Fancy.
So this, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing this wrong, I did look up the pronunciation. Asian. Did I say that right? Yeah.
You did.
So I'm going to do the Villisca axe murders.
God damn it, Katie. I wanted to do that one.
I'm sorry.
It's been on my list.
I'm sorry.
No, someone in our group requested it too, so that's good.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't see that, so there we go.
Yay! This one's for you, person whose name I don't have in front of me. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so this one actually is going to be kind of a shorter story. There's tons of history, but not really a lot about the spooky stuff. So, yeah. Here we go. On a quiet residential street in Villisca, Iowa, sits an old, large, white farm-style home. The home is charming, with its various front-facing windows and perfect-size inviting front porch. The home is close to a local park, a middle school, and several churches. So that paints a nice little picture, right? Are you picturing this cute little white farmhouse with all these nice windows and, like, a perfect area?
It sounds so quaint and cozy.
Okay, well.
I mean, I know it's not going to be. It's the Villisca axe murders, but you know.
Yeah. So, upon further investigation, the home can seem a little dark and almost ominous. All of the doors and windows have been boarded up, leaving the home seem like a shell of its former self. Adding to the ominous feeling is a large sign that reads, "The Villisca Axe Murder House."
Yep.
Yeah, and this is like a huge sign.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. It's pretty big.
Yeah, I looked it up and I was expecting like the Lizzie Borden bed and breakfast size sign. No, it's a bit bigger than that.
Right, or like a little plaque. But this thing's like a billboard cemented into the ground.
Yeah, it's, you can't miss it.
No.
So, before it became known as the Axe Murder House, the home was once filled with the laughter of the four Moore children, Herman, age 11, Mary Catherine, age 10, Arthur Boyd, age 7, and Paul Vernon, age 5, and their parents, John and Sarah. The Moores would often invite people into their home, those being adults or children, just to spend the night, and that was the case on June 10th, 1912. Lena Gertrude and Ina Mae Stillinger were having a sleepover with the Moore children. So, the kids went to a church event that night, got to hang out with some of their friends. I believe they were all part of a play, all had dinner together, and then called it a night. So, sometime between midnight and 5 a.m., a stranger entered the home through an unlocked door. So... There were two ways that someone was suspected to have gotten into the house. Entering through an unlocked door, which was quite common during this time period, just because nobody was doing shit like this back then.
Yeah. Or nobody, at least not that they were hearing about it all the time.
Right. Nobody was breaking into people's homes. You know, you didn't have to worry about waking up with a strange person standing in the middle of your living room. So they thought either they got in through an unlocked door, because everyone in this residential area always left their windows open, doors unlocked, or they thought the intruder came in while they were gone and waited in the attic until the family went to bed, which I think is a little creepier.
That's horrifying.
Because from pictures that I've seen, of course, this is an old farm style house, so the floorboards are all that like really creaky wood. So all I'm thinking about is you can clearly see through the slits between the wood is someone laying down, like, watching the family the whole time they're in this house, which is just super fucking creepy to me.
I'm sorry, what? Ew.
Yeah. So ooh. I watched something where that was a thing, like this couple were sitting on their couch watching TV and they had just installed surveillance cameras in their living room. And all of a sudden, it, like, alerted the girl's phone that something had moved behind them.
No. I need you to stop telling me this right now.
I gotta finish it. So, it sent an alert to her phone. Oh, God. And whoever it was didn't hear that. So, she, like, showed it to her boyfriend, and they got up, and someone was standing at the top of their stairs.
No. Oh, my God. I feel sick. That's horrifying. Yeah.
That is one of my biggest fears, and I swear to God, someone has been in my attic before while I was home, so no, I'm stop terrified.
It. Stop it, Katie. Yeah. Stop it. Stop doing this to me.
So, yeah.
Oh, my God.
The attic thing is definitely way creepier.
You can't see me, but my hands are covering my eyes right now. I am curling as far into myself as possible. I am so bothered by this.
Sorry.
No, you're not. You're not sorry. You are so happy you finally got a freaked out reaction from me.
Hey, I had to read it, so it's only fair that you get the full experience.
All right, well then watch out for the itty-bitty we're recording today, Katie, because I'm going to relay everything in fucking detail.
Great. Okay, so.
All right, continue. So there's somebody in their house that possibly waited in the attic until they were asleep. Got it.
Yeah.
Gross.
So regardless of when this happened, the stranger ended up grabbing a dimly lit, and this was, like, in every source that I looked on, it was described the exact same. So he picked up a dimly lit oil lamp with one hand and was carrying an axe with the other.
Gross.
Yeah. The Moore family was all resting upstairs with the children just down the hall from their parents. The intruder ignored the sleeping Stillinger sisters on the first floor and made their way up past the children to Mr. and Mrs. Moore's room. And you'll hear me say they, them, because this is still unsolved, and it could have been a female. You never know.
Yeah.
So I just said they, them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the intruder first struck Mary in the face with the blunt end of the axe. And he hit her about 7 times and then lifted the axe so high above their head that it gouged the ceiling with the axe as he brought it down more than 30 times on Joe's head.
What the fuck?
30 times, which this sounds like definitely someone who knew at least the father of this family, because that's definite overkill.
Yeah, that's... There's, like, no reason for that unless it's personal.
Right. So he finished, he murdered Mr. and Mrs. Moore, and then he moved to their children's room. Yeah. He bludgeoned each of the children with the blunt end of the axe and then went downstairs and did the same thing to the Stillinger girls. Which, can you imagine sending your children to stay with someone and this happening to them?
If I have kids, all sleepovers will be done at my house.
I've always said that, just because you literally don't know people. Like, you could have known people for 10 years and they're still hiding things. So, my kids won't go anywhere.
Yeah, there was actually a case recently where this young girl was murdered by her godmother.
Yeah, that's insane.
It just, and it wasn't even just murdered. Like, she wasn't fed. She was tortured. Horrifying. Mm-mm. You don't know people. Don't trust your kids with people. I don't know. No sleepovers.
Right. Okay. So he did the same thing to the Stillinger girls. This was another, like, Amityville story, apparently, because it didn't wake up anyone in the home. And I feel like an axe is fairly heavy. I don't think that he could have hit Sarah without waking up Joe. And then I feel like Joe would have made some sort of noise that would have woke up his children. And then at least one of the kids would have made a noise. Like, you're not hitting all of them at the same time. So I don't understand how this didn't wake up somebody in the house. Because they were all found in their beds.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd, but also, I mean, just using Luke as an example, he's a very, very deep sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there have been times I've shaken him and he does not wake up. So,
I don't know. Like, maybe it's just me. I am a light sleeper, but I can feel when someone's looking at me, if something's not right in my home, like, I can feel that, and it wakes me up out of a dead sleep. So maybe that's just me.
I mean, I'm very similar at times, but there are other times I can sleep like a fucking rock, too. So,
yeah, no, not me.
I mean, it's wild, but I could see how it would be possible.
Okay. Well, regardless of if they heard something or not, because then again, the children could have heard something and then just have been so afraid they didn't want to move.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very likely, because all of these kids, the oldest one was 11, so I mean,
that's so sad.
Yeah. So, okay, another fun fact with this is, everyone was bludgeoned with the blunt end of the axe, except for Joe. He was the only one hit with, like, the sharp end, which also, to me, says that whoever did this knew Joe, and he was not happy with him for whatever reason.
Who did you say was killed first, the husband, or?
The wife was killed first.
I'm trying to, like, make that make sense in my mind, because I would think, so if you use the sharp end, it's actually, from my knowledge of how weapons work, less painful. So, like, my mind would be, oh, okay, so you go and you kill the husband first, because he's the most likely to put up a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go for the wife, and you can take your sweet fucking time with it, I guess, because you're disgusting. But,
well, what I thought about was, apparently whoever did this knew the house layout pretty well, which is why mm-hmm. I'm more so leaning towards they were waiting in the attic, just because that would give them, you know, knowledge of how their house is set up, or they could have been in their home before. So what I'm thinking is, maybe he went upstairs, went into the room, didn't realize it was the parents' room, thought it was the children, and he just acted quickly because, I don't want to say personally because I would never murder anybody, but if I was trying to get back at someone, like if this was a revenge thing, I would kill everyone in the house so that he knew they were all gone, and then I would kill him.
Yeah, I mean, so, if you were a vindictive person, I could see how that would be your go-to.
And the way that he was murdered, whoever did it was very vindictive, because why was he hit over 30 times and everyone else was only hit 3 or 4 times?
But also, why was everybody else hit with the blunt end? Because that takes longer.
Well, it does take longer, but the sharp end of the axe would cause more disfiguration to the face. So, I feel like it would, because if you were hit in the head, yeah, your head would probably be cracked open. But if you're hit in the face with the sharp end of the axe, it's tearing skin, it's ripping your scalp off. Like, I feel like it would cause more damage, therefore proving more of a point. And then that all goes back to how many times he was hit, because that was definite overkill, and everyone else was only hit, like I said, 3 or 4 times.
I don't know. The whole thing's fucking weird. No, like, professionals didn't solve this. I don't think we're going to.
But maybe we could. Anyway.
Maybe we could, yeah. We'll go get our investigators' licenses and just fucking do the thing.
Okay. It doesn't actually take long to become a PI, so that may be on the books.
All right, well, let's do it, Katie.
Okay, so, of course, everyone's faces were left unrecognizable. Obviously, they were all hit in the face with an axe, whether it be the sharp end or the blunt end. It's doing some damage.
Yeah.
So this is where it gets a little weird. So whoever did this took the time to cover all of the bodies completely with either sheets or clothing.
Sure.
Yeah. They also took fabric and covered all of the windows and mirrors, which I kind of get the windows so that people didn't see in until the bodies were discovered. But the mirrors,
Maybe whoever did it had that, it's some kind of either mythology or religious belief about mirrors and their, like, link to the other world.
Yeah, see, okay, I'm glad you said that. So, I was thinking that they did that as, like, I don't know. Okay, so some cultures, when someone dies, they cover the mirrors in their home so that their souls aren't captured, if that makes sense. So maybe they did that because they had that same, I don't know, I wouldn't say that's a religious belief, I guess spiritual belief.
Yeah.
So maybe they were afraid of that, and then there was the whole, well, maybe he just couldn't, or they just couldn't look at themselves. But what he did after this tells me otherwise.
Oh, boy. Did he, like, stay in the house and, like, eat their food and shit?
Yeah. That's exactly what he did. So he covered all of the mirrors, all of the windows with clothing and fabric. He also cooked himself a meal, which he did not eat. Yeah. And then he took 2 pounds of uncooked bacon and placed it in the middle of the living room floor along with a keychain of some sort.
What?
Yeah. He also, back then they had wash bowls, so you know those big bowls with like the pitcher that you pour the water in and wash your hands with.
Mm-hmm.
He also washed his hands in the bowl, but didn't dump the water out. So when investigators found the bowl, it was just clear water with, like, a swirl of blood in it. Which kind of makes me think maybe he hadn't been gone as long as they thought, because I feel like the blood would have settled to the bottom or even mixed in with the water. So that was a little weird to me.
That, I wouldn't have even thought about that, but yeah, that's really... What the fuck is this case?
Right. That, I was kind of like, because blood is definitely, you know, viscous. It's going to drop to the bottom of the water or, like I said, mix in with it. So it would just look like dirty water. But anyway.
Yeah, but also, what the fuck's with the bacon?
Yeah, I don't, at first, I've read that maybe it was the start of a ritual, like the covering of the mirrors and laying out pork. And this was just a whole entirely different rabbit hole, but a lot of cultures associate pork with being unclean. So it could have been some sort of ritual he, she, whatever was trying to set up, but maybe chickened out at the last minute. So I don't really know what the deal with the bacon was, because it wasn't like it was left on a counter or left in a pot. It was placed in the middle of their living room floor, which is just a little strange.
I mean, yeah, but Katie, he wouldn't have chickened out. He would have porked out.
Get out. Get out.
Okay, fine, I'll leave. You can finish this recording without me.
Just put a star on the mic. Jeez.
She does want so desperately to be in this closet, so. For those of you that don't know, Astara is my cat. Mm-hmm. She's such a little bib.
So, along with all that weird shit they decided to do at the home, They also took any house keys, left the house, and then locked the door behind them. So a couple days went by and nobody could contact the family. I believe they said it was exactly 3 days. And Joe's brother was sent to the house to figure out why no one was answering the door, or, you know, no one was able to contact any members of the family. So he walks in, and I imagine this was June. There's no air conditioning. So I imagine it probably smelled horrible because of all these bodies in this heat. They were covered. There's raw bacon chilling on the floor. Like, it probably smelled terrible.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but...
You're fine.
They had friends spending the night.
Yeah.
What? Were their parents not concerned?
Yeah, as far as I could tell, they were one of the groups of people that ended up sending Joe's brother over. That kind of struck me as odd too. So I've seen between 2 to 3 days of them not being able to contact the family, but unless it was pre-planned that the kids were going to be staying at that home for a couple of days, I would have definitely went over there after not being able to contact them by, you know, knocking on the door or whatever. So I kind of wrote it off to maybe because it was the summertime, they were just going to spend a few days over there. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. And it wasn't like today where you can shoot a quick text message and be like, hey, are my kids okay? Kind of thing.
I mean, maybe, but like, you'd think it would have been specified. Yeah, they were supposed to be over there for several days.
Yeah, so I actually dug into that a little bit, and I didn't see any information about the Stillinger family at all as to why they didn't, you know, check on their kids sooner or anything like that, because then that made me a little suspicious of them.
I mean, yeah.
Because, I mean, the two of your kids, and I believe they were their only children.
Oh my god. Yeah, no, if I had somebody who was like, oh yeah, your kids are gonna spend the night at my house, and then I can't get a hold of them for more than a few hours.
Yeah, and that goes back to my kids are never going to anyone's home. So yeah, you're kind of on the same wavelength that I was. This story had several sections that made me stop and like cross-reference every website that I named before, because... Mm-hmm. Of course, because this happened so long ago, there's a few different details here and there. I tried to include all of them. But there's still a lot of things that you're like, wait a minute. What? Because this is, even back then, was a residential street. So if someone snuck into their home in the attic, unless the entire town was at church or wherever they were, why didn't anyone see anybody snooping around their home? Or... like you said, why didn't these parents try to contact their children? It's just, there's a lot of, like, what going on in this story?
Yeah, that's really fucking weird. I don't know.
Yeah, so Joe's brother was sent to the house to check on them. He walked into, of course, this mess, and he immediately notified the police. So this had to be the beginning of shitty-ass police work. Just because this, reading this really made me pretty angry.
Yeah.
So, investigators entered the home. They, of course, saw all the bodies. And I don't know if, when this stopped being a thing, but a lot of times way back then, I don't even know what it would have been called back then. A coroner is what it would have been now. They didn't take the bodies off. They cleaned the bodies and prepared them at the home. I'm not really sure when that stopped, but I would say early 1900s it was probably still going on. So they would bring tables and clean the body, get it ready for a viewing, if you could have a viewing. And then all of that would be held at the home.
Hmm.
So I'm guessing that's why these bodies were not moved while there was an investigation was open, because investigators came, pulled the sheets from the body, looked at the bodies. I guess they took photos because there are crime scene photos, and oh my god. Crime scene photos are out there. They're horrible. And then they left. So, meanwhile, while they're investigating, hundreds of people are standing outside of this house because news travels fast in a small town.
Yeah.
And as soon as the investigators left, every single one of those people entered the home.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't mean entered, looked, left. No.
You know, they, like, entered and they took stuff, didn't they?
Yeah, so they entered the home. They were, okay, this is really fucking disgusting. At one point, someone was actually posing with the bodies.
What the fuck?
Yeah, so the bodies were being touched. Someone actually took a piece of Joe's skull.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's actually still floating around out there. So they were posing with the bodies, touching them, moving things, stealing things, tracking God knows what all through this house for the remainder of the day. So the next day, investigators come back and they bring bloodhounds to try to, you know, pick up on any kind of scent. And the dog is so fucking confused because now there's been so many people in the house. So the investigation basically stopped there because there was nothing that could be picked up because everything had been touched, moved. At one point, I saw one of the bodies was even taken out of a bed.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so literally everything was fucked. It was just, it was really, really dumb.
Who does that? Oh my god.
Yeah, so any chance of any evidence being found was completely destroyed. Despite this, there were a couple of suspects. The first one was a man named Frank Jones. He actually was Joe Moore's boss for about 7 years. He owned a farm equipment company, and Joe worked for him, like I said, for 7 years. They parted ways, and it didn't go well, because guess what business Joe ended up in?
I don't want to guess.
Selling farm equipment. So he was now a rival business to his former boss.
Lovely.
Yeah. There, of course, was some bad blood between the two of them, but everyone who talked about Mr. Jones said there was no way he was mad enough to have slaughtered his whole family. Even though there was a nice juicy rumor going around town that Mr. Moore was having an affair with Frank Jones's daughter-in-law, which was his son's wife.
Oh, boy.
There was never any proof of this rumor. Of course, it was probably just something somebody made up to make the story a little juicier. But, like I said, everyone said there was no way he was upset enough to have murdered this man's entire family.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be pretty fucking extreme.
I would say so. So, the second suspect even confessed to the murders. But the confession was quickly recanted because of so-called police brutality. So apparently the confession was beaten out of him.
Okay, so it was very coerced.
Yeah, so... So an English immigrant, Lynn George Jacqueline Kelly, wow, had a history of mental instability and sexual deviance. Kelly was left-handed, and it was determined that whoever did these murders was left-handed because of where the, like, mark in the ceiling and everything was, how, like, the part, how the axe had hit their heads and all of that, and the sexual deviance part comes in because apparently, this is graphic warning, Mrs. Moore and two of the female children were sexually assaulted with the handle of the axe. Yeah.
Although that also begs the question, though, were they sexually assaulted during the crime, or was it done afterwards when everybody was just traipsing through the crime scene?
Yeah, and there would have been no way to tell this.
Yeah.
Another thing with everybody going through the house was the murder weapon was actually left in the room where the Stillinger girls were murdered, but someone stole it. Yeah, why would you not remove that from a crime scene? But like I said.
just why?
Humans are very curious creatures.
No, humans are disgusting creatures. There's a difference.
You're right. So, Mr. Kelly, like I said, was left-handed, so that was the number one reason they thought he was a suspect. That accompanied with the fact that he dropped off some bloody clothes the day after the murders at a local laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
And he also tried to pose as a Scotland Yard officer to gain entry into the home at the time of the investigation, but he was denied access. Okay, so this might make me sound really dumb, but Scotland Yard... That's in England, right? Like, those officers are from Europe, right?
They are part of the UK. We actually briefly talked about them in the Blackout Ripper case for the Patreon.
Okay. So that's why that reminded me. So why he thought a police officer from the UK would be allowed into this crime scene kind of throws me, but I mean, as shoddy as this police work was, I guess it wouldn't have really mattered either way. But he was denied entry to the home. And because of his recanted confession, a jury refused to indict him. So that was pretty much the end of any suspects. So it is still an open case. No one knows what happened. No one will probably ever know exactly what happened because they did a shitty job of investigating it.
Yeah.
The Vasila Axe Murders... Vasilica. Oh my goodness. Axe murders were also the first in a long string of axe murders throughout the entire country. All were done with an axe and a dimly lit oil lamp was left at the scene of each crime. No connection was ever made to the other murders, so that tells me those were probably copycat murders.
Yeah.
Maybe. The home was never sold, never torn down. You can actually go visit it right now, and here's where we get into the spooky part.
Yay!
So, last price I saw for you to be able to tour this house was only $5. So you could get in and do a daytime tour, and then they charge $430 to stay overnight to do an investigation.
No thanks.
Yeah, no, I would probably do the daytime tour, but I'm not staying overnight.
I would absolutely do the daytime tour, but you want to talk about pissed off spirits, that's where you find them.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Mm-hmm. So, with such a dark past, it should come as no surprise that the home is insanely haunted. Locals say, every night around 2 a.m., a train goes behind the home. Visitors have stated that after the train blows its horn, a light fog can be seen filling up the bedrooms that once belonged to the Moore family. Is this train whistle triggering these haunted events? Some locals have a theory that maybe the murders were happening while the train was going behind the home, which may have stifled some of the inevitable noise.
Huh.
Which would make a little bit of sense, because as far as I know, the tracks are fairly close to the back of this home. So, trains are super fucking loud, like even loud enough for you not to be able to hear what's going on in your own home. So that definitely would have explained it. But that also takes it back to saying, unless this person was from out of town and had stayed for a few weeks, how did you know exactly what time that train would be going behind the home?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Maybe he worked for... whatever the fuck you call it, the train company.
Yeah, it could have been anyone. It could have been someone who worked for the train company. It could have been someone, like a disgruntled employee. It could have been a former boss. It could have been someone that just decided he wanted to end that family. Like, there's no telling who it was. And it is far too late to figure that out now.
Yeah.
So, investigators have entered the home and, of course, taken photos, and most of the photos taken at this home are covered with orbs. All ranging in size and shape and even color sometimes. There are a few clear still images, and one that's gotten a lot of attention on the internet that I don't really agree with. I'll tell you about it, and you can tell me if you agree with it. But a professional photographer took a photo in the attic of this, like, chair that was just sitting there. And the front, let's see, the front left leg is lifted slightly off the ground, but all of the other legs are touching the ground. And people are flipping shit saying that this is paranormal. I think maybe it was just off center, like it's not balanced.
Yeah, it sounds like there's one short leg on a fucking chair.
Yeah, I mean, and I was like, well, maybe someone should have sat in that chair and seen if it was just wobbly, because it's visibly shorter than the other legs. And I mean, this photo has gotten so many views and has been shared like hundreds of thousands of times, and people are like, the front leg is lifted up, this has to be paranormal. And I'm like, no, actually it's not, but okay, believe whatever you want to believe.
Yeah, I just googled it.
Do you see it?
I'm trying to, like, find a bigger photo of it. It just, honestly, it almost even looks like a trick of the light, even. Like, it doesn't.
Hold on. Because I really want you to see it, like, the picture that I saw. Because it was, like, a super clear, very large picture. And you can, there it is. You can definitely, so if you type in Velisca House Murders chair photo, it's the second picture that pops up.
It is definitely not the second picture that pops up for my Jesus fuck cat. Holy fuck, I just had a heart attack.
Oh no. All right, I'm sending it to you on Skype. The website, it shows, like, the perfectly clear picture.
Great. Thank you. Because the second photo that pulls up for me is one of the crime scene photos. And so I was staring at that, and then Astara started fucking clawing at the gate as I'm looking at that, and holy shit, my heart.
I heard. Okay, so apparently there's a lot of fuss over this chair photo. Rebecca's seen it. I think it's crap, but regardless.
Yeah, I think it looks almost like a trick of the light, so.
Yeah, either that or literally one of the legs is shorter than the other.
Yeah.
No big deal. So people have caught black mist, which normally is not a good thing. Fog, some say they've caught apparitions. All the pictures I found look definitely doctored. So, we'll try to include some on our Facebook page or Instagram or whatever so you guys can look at them, and probably a lot more than that on Patreon.
Yeah, definitely. We try to post a lot more photos on Patreon just so you guys feel like you're getting your money's worth.
So, visitors mentioned that the air feels heavy when climbing the staircase. You get an overwhelming sense of dread, fear, and depression, which, duh. Any empath would probably get that walking into that home.
Yep.
Several other overnight visitors, which definitely this part made me say, oh, hell no, I'm not staying in that house overnight. Several overnight paranormal investigators have said that they have seen a shadow man dragging an axe across the floor around 2 or 3 a.m.
Yeah, fuck that.
And you can hear it in some EVPs.
Yeah, fuck that. So hard. So that is
the last thing I want to see.
Nope.
Paranormal investigators that leave the home from overnight trips report that they have played, quote-unquote, with the children. I looked into what this was, and apparently they do the stereotypical rolling a ball back and forth. They'll also do the flashlight game, which is where you set a flashlight on a table, and if it turns on, they answer questions, whether they turn it on, turn it off, whatever. And then they also record random giggling from the children's bedrooms and from the guest room where the Stillinger girls were murdered. Banging can be heard coming from each of the bedrooms at all times of the night and day. Even people who just pass by the home, walking past the home, said that they hear random footsteps, banging, screeching, like all kinds of random stuff.
No thanks.
Children's voices can be heard singing and giggling. Objects have been said to relocate themselves within the home, and not just, like, sliding across the table or whatever. There was one story I read that said one of the investigators had put down a voice recorder on the kitchen table, and nobody could find it. Well, someone went up into the attic to investigate. This was actually the same time that picture was taken
of
the paranormal chair, and the voice recorder was in the attic.
I fucking hate all of that, Katie.
Yeah. So
now maybe I'm glad that you did this one instead of me.
So on a YouTube channel for the Travel Channel, there have been EVPs recording saying, "I killed them," which is just, don't like that.
Yeah.
And then finally, the last bit of paranormal facts, I guess you could say, that I found was in November of 2014. At this time is when the home had been open for a few years for tours. That start, like I said, at $430 a night, but that is per team, so I guess that's not too bad. Robert Stephen Larson Jr. joined a group of his friends to take a tour of the home. He was alone in the bedroom where the Moore children were bludgeoned to death. Soon after he had entered the room, he called his friends on a two-way radio, screaming and crying for help. His friends found him lying on the ground, and he had a stab wound in his chest.
Oh, what the fuck? No!
Yeah. So he was immediately rushed to the hospital, but doctors at the hospital say that the wound was self-inflicted. So here's a few things about that.
Mm-hmm.
This man had no weapons on him at all. There were no weapons found at the scene. And why the fuck would you stab yourself? I mean, I know some people do crazy shit like that all the time for attention or whatever. Mm-hmm. Self-harm is a very big thing, of course. But he swears up and down to this day that he did not do it. There was nothing in the room that he could have done it with. He said he just felt like a stabbing pain in his chest, and he kind of felt like he was having a heart attack, and then he saw the blood. So, I don't know exactly where that would have come from, but this man swears up and down that he didn't do it to himself, and I kind of believe him.
Yeah, my mind wants to say he was, like, possessed.
Something.
I don't know. I don't like it. The whole time you were telling this story, my cat Tiger Lily was staring at me through the gate and freaking me out too, so that didn't help.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that is the last bit of paranormal information I could find on the home. Like I said, you can go and tour the home. I don't know if you can do it right now because of the corona lockdowns. But you can go and tour the home. It has been not really remodeled, but it was cleaned and reorganized is what I read to match what it would have looked like in 1912. So obviously, you know, all those people walked in when the murders happened, but you also have to take into consideration that the house was abandoned for many years. So there have been several people in and out of there. Mm-hmm. Homeless people have taken shelter there. So someone had to go in and quote-unquote, stage the home. I did read that all of the original furniture is still in the home, which is really freaking creepy, because if you're staying overnight, are you sleeping in those beds?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, if you're ever in the area, you can definitely check it out. And if you ever do, or if you ever have, send us pictures.
Yes, pictures, personal stories. If you were haunted there, please, we need to fucking know about it so that I can go cry myself to sleep at night after reading it. Or just cry and not sleep, because that's the more likely situation that would occur.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Katie?
Yes.
What were your CTKs this week?
So, I was supposed to have been on vacation for the past 5 days, because my boyfriend's birthday was last Thursday.
Yeah.
But I was on vacation, but I found out that my store was audited while I was gone, and that didn't go well, so I get to walk into that tomorrow. I've been dealing with a very rambunctious puppy, which isn't definitely not really a bad thing per se. It is getting a little frustrating just because she's very hard-headed. So, CTK has definitely been recording this fucking episode.
Seriously, we're going on, like, 2.5 hours because Skype keeps cutting out and all of the issues.
Every single fucking issue. So that's probably the biggest CTK. What about yours?
Also that, keep in mind when we are recording, so I live in California, so it's very fucking hot, and when we're recording, I can't have my AC on, and I'm also locked in the hottest part of my bedroom, which is this little closet that also has a cutout for a dog door, so there's, like, no insulation in that part.
Exciting.
Yeah, I'm currently melting and have, like, an ice pack pressed up against my neck. Usually it's not so bad because Katie and I can get, you know, 2 episodes recorded in 2 hours or an episode and itty bitty done in like an hour and a half, but for obvious reasons that's not really happening right now. So that is one. I think my other one would be I'm having a lot of really weird memories come back from my childhood, and so I went down a rabbit hole this weekend, and I am probably that one weirdo who uses Facebook incorrectly. So I started adding a bunch of people I went to high school with for 1 year.
Oh.
Yeah, and I just reached out and messaged several of them, because there's this other girl that I'm trying to find that I remember being really close with. I can't remember her last name for the life of me, but so I message these other people who barely remember me, and I'm like, hi, do you remember this person? Here's her name, this is what she looks like, this is the last rumor I remember going around about her, that's all the information that I have. So, so I'm being that weirdo on Facebook at the current moment. Yeah. Other than that, though, I do have a positive one, and this one I believe Katie and I both share as, you know, a positive thrill.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have a P.O. box, officially.
Yeah!
Yay! So now if you guys want to send us mail, whether it is a letter or just some spooky looking thing that you found somewhere, or something that just made you go, oh, hey, this, they would love this. Please don't send us haunted dolls, though. I fucking refuse.
Yeah, no. No thanks.
No haunted dolls. That is illegal. Not allowed here. Send them to Emma and Christine at that, and that's why we drink. I will not be getting a Blue's Clues cabinet to keep your haunted dolls in, so do not send them here. I have enough spirits following me around. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. Let me know, Katie, and I'll cut it out. But Katie's aunt, before we even started this podcast, reached out to me and told me that I had spirits trying to contact me.
Yeah.
And So, like, I have enough of them, you guys, that I have strangers to me reaching out to me on the internet saying, hey, these ghosties are trying to talk to you, so just don't. Mm-hmm. Don't
please,
send me more.
Please don't.
But anyways, so we have a P.O. box, and you can make any mail you want to send to us out to Chills, Thrills, and Kills, or CTK Pod, and send them to 520 North Ventu Park Road, number 273, Newberry Park, California, 91320. And I will be putting that in the episode notes so that you guys can find it easier. It's also pinned as an announcement in our Facebook group, and I will post it to our Instagram as well. It'll just be everywhere so you guys can send us fun stuff.
Yes.
Or don't. Stuff. I don't know. But please do. We want fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think we should probably end this before my computer explodes or something.
I would hate for that to happen. So, guys, if you like us, maybe even love us, you can support us on Patreon. You can find that at patreon.com/ctkpod. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to do that, though, which I don't know why you wouldn't, we post extra episodes, background stories about us, gift exchanges visually, which there will be another one coming very soon, I've been told. Mm-hmm. yeah, so you should just do that. But otherwise, if you don't want to join us on Patreon, you can find us on Twitter or Instagram at
CTKPod.
You can join our amazing Facebook group at
CTKPodcast.
And you can send us listener stories or the non-snail mail version of whatever you wanted to send to us, or both, or whatever, to
chillsthrillsandkills@gmail.com.
All right, guys. Well, until next time.
Bye.
Bye.